A Kotra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Kotra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are tackling something pretty monumental.
We really are.
We're diving into Friedrich Nietzsche's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. It's known for being incredibly challenging, but also really poetic and radical.
Absolutely. And it's not just abstract philosophy, is it? It feels intensely relevant even now because it's Nietzsche's big response to something he saw happening over a century ago, this huge cultural crisis he famously called the death of God.
Okay, that phrase, death of God, it sounds so dramatic. For people maybe not familiar, we're not just talking about atheism in a simple sense, are we? It's deeper than that.
Much deeper, yeah. For Nietzsche, it signified the total collapse of the underlying foundation of Western thought. You know, the traditional religious, moral, metaphysical truths that society had basically relied on for like 2,000 years.
Yeah. So when that Judeo-Christian worldview starts to crumble or becomes unbelievable for the modern mind.
Exactly. The source of absolute meaning of objective value just vanishes. And this vacuum, he warned, this void, it leads directly to nihilism.
Nihilism. Kind of terrifying feeling that life is ultimately meaningless.
Precisely. That crushing weight of pointlessness.
So, okay, if the foundations are gone and we're sort of left staring into this abyss, the core mission of Zarathustra is basically answering, well, what now? How do we live? How do we create meaning ourselves?
That's it, exactly. And his answer is, well, it's demanding. It's the necessity of forging entirely new life-affirming values. And the pathway he proposes is through this ideal of the Übermensch.
The Overman.
The Overman. Yeah, the future goal, the meaning of the earth, really. It's a call for radical self-creation, self-mastery.
Wow. Okay, before we jump into the book itself, maybe let's spend a minute on the author. Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche lived 1844 to 1900.
Right, and he wasn't just some armchair philosopher. He was genuinely brilliant academically, a prodigy, really.
Mm. Didn't he get a professorship incredibly young?
Yeah, youngest ever, I think, to hold the chair of classical philology at the University of Basel. He was only 24.
And that background, being a philologist, someone who studies ancient texts, language, culture, really meticulously, that's key, isn't it?
Absolutely crucial. It meant he approached morality and culture not as divine revelations, but as human constructs, like languages, things that evolved historically, psychologically, things people invented.
So he could sort of dissect Western morality, trace its history, see how it was built.
Exactly. And that historical perspective gave him this unique insight into the death of God. He didn't see it as just a minor intellectual adjustment. He saw it as a cataclysm, a fundamental rupture in culture.
You really felt the weight of it.
He did. He understood the scale of the void it left behind.
Yeah.
And that's why he was kind of uniquely positioned to tackle it.
And interestingly, he didn't write like a dry philosophical treatise to lay out his ideas.
No, not at all. He chose this incredibly literary, almost prophetic style. He uses the figure of Zarathustra, who's loosely based on Zoroaster, the ancient Persian prophet, to deliver these ideas. It's full of poetry, metaphor, allegory. It feels less like a logical argument and more like a spiritual challenge. It really grabs you.
It demands something from the reader, doesn't it? A kind of personal commitment.
Definitely. Okay, so let's get into the book itself. Thus Spoke Zarathustra. What's the basic story?
Well, it follows this figure, Zarathustra. He spent 10 years in solitude up on a mountain gaining wisdom, and now he feels ready, overflowing almost, and he comes down to share it with humanity.
And his goal, what's he trying to teach?
Essentially, he wants to guide people towards achieving greatness, towards creating meaning for themselves through intense self-mastery, overcoming their limitations.
And the subtitle is pretty telling, isn't it? A book for all and none.
Yeah, what's that about? It sounds contradictory.
Well, it is a bit of a paradox. The message itself, the potential for greatness, is universal. It applies to all humanity, in theory. But Nietzsche was also pretty pessimistic, maybe realistic, about who would actually get it.
Okay.
He knew that only a few people, those willing to reject easy comforts and embrace difficult growth, would truly understand or even be capable of this demanding path of self-overcoming. So for everyone, but maybe only understood by no one. Or very few.
Right, not for the faint of heart. And structurally, the book seems to have a kind of two-part movement.
Yeah, you could see it that way. First, there's a deconstruction phase. Zarathustra comes down and starts attacking the pillars of the old world. Things like conventional morality, pity, the state, the pursuit of just simple, passive happiness.
Tearing down the old idols.
Exactly. And then from that cleared ground, there's the creation phase. He starts proposing these new ideals, these new values necessary for reaching the Übermensch.
And there are three big concepts that seem central, right? They keep coming up.
Yes. Three core interwoven ideas. First, obviously, the Übermensch, Overman, the goal, the meaning we should aim for. Second, the driving force behind it all, the will to power.
Which needs some careful explanation, I think.
Definitely. We'll get to that. And third, the ultimate test, both psychologically and morally, the eternal recurrence.
Okay, let's dig into the sections. It starts pretty dramatically with Zarathustra coming down from his mountain.
Right, Zarathustra's prologue. He comes down, and the first person he meets is this old saint in the forest who, incredibly, hasn't even heard the news that God is dead.
Wow, that really shows the disconnect, doesn't it? How profound this shift is, but how slow it is to filter through society.
Exactly. Then he goes into the marketplace, the town square, you know, the world of ordinary people, and, well, he fails. Miserably.
What happened?
He tries to preach to the crowd. He sees them as the herd, basically, and he lays it on thick. He proclaims, man is something that shall be overcome. He introduces the idea of the Übermensch as the goal.
Okay, bold opening.
Yeah. And then he contrasts it with the last man. This is Nietzsche's vision of where humanity might end up if it doesn't strive for greatness.
The last man.
What's that?
It's this contemptible creature, someone who seeks only comfort, safety, trivial pleasures, predictable little happinesses. They've invented happiness, he says, by basically eliminating all risk, all striving, all suffering. They just want to be comfortable.
And how does the crowd react to this sermon?
They laugh at him. They mock him, think he's crazy or just putting on a show. They want entertainment, not this harsh message about overcoming themselves.
So his first attempt at teaching the masses is a total flop.
Complete flop. Then there's this incident with a tightrope walker who falls and dies. Zarathustra carries the body away, and he realizes his message isn't for the herd. It's not for everyone right now. He needs to find companions, seekers, individuals who are ready to break free and create something new.
That failure really shapes the rest of the book then. He's looking for the few, not the many. Exactly. And that leads into part one, where he starts laying out the blueprint for those potential companions. And the most crucial speech here is on the three metamorphoses.
Ah, yes, the camel, the lion, and the child. This is like a map for spiritual transformation, isn't it?
It really is. First stage, the spirit becomes a camel, the beast of burden. It kneels down and takes on the heaviest weights, tradition, duty, morality, all the thou shalts imposed by society and religion.
So accepting the rules, carrying the load.
Right. Dutiful, obedient. But then, in the loneliest desert, the spirit needs to transform again. It becomes a lion.
The lion. What does that represent?
Raw power, defiance. The lion says, I will. Its task is to win freedom from the old values. It has to slay the great dragon whose scales glitter with all the thou shalts of history.
So rebellion, breaking free from constraints.
Yes, achieving negative freedom, freedom from, but that's not the final stage. Rebellion alone isn't enough.
Because it's still defined by what it's fighting against.
Exactly. It's still reactive.
Yeah.
The final, highest transformation is becoming a child.
The child. Why a child?
Because the child represents innocence, forgetting the past burdens. It's a sacred yes to life. It's spontaneous, creative, like a wheel rolling of its own accord. The child doesn't just reject old values. It creates new ones, joyfully, affirmingly.
Camel bears, lion destroys, child creates. That's a powerful image.
It sets the stage for everything that follows. And part two introduces the engine that drives this transformation, the will to power, or Willgemacht. Zarathustra famously says, where I found the living, there I found will to power.
Okay, let's pause here. Because will to power, that phrase has a lot of baggage, doesn't it? It often gets misinterpreted as just like a desire for brute force, domination, tyranny.
It absolutely does. And that's a gross, though unfortunately common, simplification. Nietzsche's idea is much more nuanced.
But how should we understand it?
For Nietzsche, it's the fundamental drive inherent in all living things, not just humans, to grow, expand, overcome obstacles, express their strength, strive, create. It's the drive to discharge energy, to become more.
So it's not necessarily about dominating others.
Not primarily, no. That's just one expression, often a primitive or distorted one. The highest form of the will to power, for Nietzsche, is self-overcoming. The artist striving to create a masterpiece, the philosopher struggling for truth, the individual pushing their own limits. That's the will to power in its more refined forms.
Okay, that makes more sense. It's an internal drive for growth and mastery, not just external control.
Precisely. And understanding it this way helps make sense of some of his critiques in part two. For example, he talks on the tarantulas.
The tarantulas. Who are they?
They represent the preachers of equality, but he argues their motivation isn't genuine love or justice. It's actually hidden envy, resentment, a kind of vengeful desire to bring down the strong or the exceptional. It's their own weak will to power disguised as morality.
Wow, that's a sharp critique.
It is. And then there's his controversial take on pity. He warns against pity, seeing it as debilitating.
Why? Isn't compassion good?
For Zarathustra, true love for humanity isn't about coddling weakness or just soothing pain. That, he thinks, can actually reinforce helplessness. Real love is tougher. It demands strength. It challenges others to overcome their suffering, to grow stronger themselves. Pity, in his view, often just multiplies suffering and weakens the human spirit.
So it's a kind of tough love focused on potential rather than just present pain.
A very tough love, yeah. Which leads us naturally into part three, the philosophical heart, maybe the climax of the book. The concept of the eternal recurrence.
Right, this is the big one. The idea that everything that has happened will happen again, infinitely, exactly the same way.
Yes. It's presented as a thought experiment, really, in the section called The Vision and the Riddle. Imagine a demon whispers this to you. This life, as you live it now, with every joy, every pain, every thought, every tiny detail, you'll have to live it again and again, countless times.
Ugh, just thinking about it, it's overwhelming. Potentially crushing.
Exactly. Nietzsche calls it the greatest weight. It's meant to induce a kind of existential nausea. He uses this image of a shepherd choking on a black snake that has crawled into his throat.
What does the snake represent?
The snake symbolizes the horror of eternal repetition, especially the repetition of all the smallness, the mediocrity, the things we regret or despise in life and in ourselves, the thought of that coming back forever. It's paralyzing.
So what's the solution? How do you deal with that?
Zarathustra yells at the shepherd, bite! Bite its head off! Bite! You have to confront the horror directly, accept it, even affirm it.
Bite the head off the snake, meaning embrace the recurrence.
Yes. To overcome the nausea and say yes to your life exactly as it is, with everything included. This act of radical acceptance, this affirmation, leads to what Nietzsche calls mor fati, the love of one's fate.
Loving your fate, meaning loving everything that happens, good and bad, because it's all part of your life.
Precisely. It forces you into this position of ultimate responsibility. If you knew you had to live this very moment infinitely, would you choose it? Would you will it? Can you affirm your existence so completely?
That's an incredibly high bar. It's easy to say you accept things, but to genuinely love every part of your fate, especially the suffering, that seems almost superhuman.
It's the ultimate psychological test, definitely. Nice. And it serves as a kind of practical guide to live in such a way that you could will the eternal return of every moment.
Okay, so after this intense climax, we get to part four, which feels a bit different, almost stranger. Zarathustra meets these figures called the higher men.
Yeah, this part is interesting. The higher men are characters who represent various attempts at human greatness that have ultimately fallen short of the Übermensch. You have figures like the last Pope who lost his faith, the ugliest man who represents self-loathing, the meticulous scientist who lacks spirit.
So they're kind of almost greats, people who tried but didn't quite make it.
Exactly. They've achieved a lot. In some ways, they're often learned, reflective. Maybe they've overcome certain old values like the lion did. But they're stuck.
Stuck how?
They're often mired in despair, nostalgia for the old certainties, self-doubt. And critically, they're still bound by pity. Pity for humanity. Pity for themselves. They haven't reached the creative joy of the child. They can't affirm life in the way Zarathustra demands.
They haven't bitten the snake's head off yet.
Not even close. And their collective misery, their longing for comfort or easy answers, becomes Zarathustra's final temptation.
A temptation to what?
To lower his standards. To feel sorry for them. To become their shepherd. To lead them gently instead of demanding the difficult path of the Übermensch. There's this bizarre scene, the Ass Festival, where they end up worshiping a donkey.
Seriously?
Yeah. It symbolizes how quickly even these higher types can regress to superstition and idol worship when the burden of self-creation gets too heavy.
So they represent the failure to fully embrace the challenge.
Right. Zarathustra recognizes they are important steps, maybe bridges towards the Übermensch, but they aren't the goal themselves. He has to leave them behind to continue his own path, his own becoming. The book ends with him sort of renewed, ready for his great noon.
Okay, so pulling back from the narrative, what are the really crucial themes or messages we should take away from this incredibly dense work?
Well, first and foremost, I think it's the death of God and the call for active creation. The loss of old certainties isn't just a negative, it's an opportunity, even a command, to become creators of value ourselves.
Right. So the takeaway isn't just despair, it's responsibility. It makes you think, you know, how much time do we spend maybe complaining about a lack of meaning versus actually trying to build it in our own lives?
Exactly. Second, the will to power redefined as self-mastery. It's not about dominating others, but about that continuous, difficult project of overcoming your own limitations, your own weaknesses. It's the engine driving that journey from camel to lion to child.
So the reflection there might be, what are the small daily ways we actually exercise that? Facing a fear, learning something hard. How do we practice self-overcoming?
Mm-hmm. And third, that ultimate test, the eternal recurrence. Using it as a kind of moral compass. Will this moment, this choice, this life, to return forever?
It forces a radical kind of ownership, doesn't it? It challenges us to choose actions we can genuinely affirm, actions we truly love, without regret or wishing things were different.
Absolutely. And maybe a fourth point is the powerful critique of herd morality and The Last Man. It's a stark warning against complacency, against seeking only comfort and security, against mediocrity.
Yeah, the book really pushes you to choose the difficult path, the rope over the abyss, towards the Overman, rather than just settling for safety and conformity down in the valley with The Last Man. Makes you ask, where am I just going along with the crowd for comfort's sake?
Definitely. Now, aside from the big ideas, the book is famous for its language. It's incredibly poetic, full of memorable lines.
Yeah, Ichi was a master stylist. Let's share a few key quotes or ideas that really capture the essence.
Okay, how about Zarathustra's description of humanity's current state? Man is a rope. Tied between beast and overman, a rope over an abyss.
That really paints a picture, doesn't it? We're this fragile transitional thing stretched between our animal past and this potential future greatness. Being human is being in danger, being a process, not a finished product.
Right. Our significance lies in being that bridge, that dangerous crossing.
Then there's the map we discussed of three metamorphoses of the spirit, I tell you, how the spirit becomes a camel and the camel a lion. And the lion, finally, a child.
So concise, so powerful. Duty, then rebellion, then finally innocent creation. It's the whole journey in one sentence.
And maybe the most famous distillation of Nietzsche's existential call, become who you are.
Which, as we've seen, isn't about finding some pre-existing fixed self.
No, it's the opposite, isn't it? It's an imperative to actively create yourself. To sculpt your character, your values, your life through constant effort and self-overcoming, breaking free from just being what society or your past made you.
You have to become it. It's not just waiting there to be discovered.
So, thinking about listeners,
How
can we actually apply some of this incredibly demanding philosophy in our everyday lives? It feels quite abstract.
It does, but I think there are concrete takeaways. First, maybe, is personal value creation. Stop passively waiting for meaning to be handed to you from tradition, from a job title, from social approval.
So actively decide what you find meaningful.
Yes. What do you truly value deep down, independent of external pressures? And then crucially, start aligning your choices, career, relationships, how you spend your time with those self-chosen values. That's building your own meaning.
Okay, that's practical. What else?
How about consciously practicing self-overcoming? Frame challenges not as threats, but as opportunities for growth, for exercising that will to power internally.
Like deliberately pick something hard.
Yeah. Learn a difficult new skill. Confront a fear you usually avoid. Push your physical or mental limits in some way. See life as this ongoing project of becoming stronger, more resilient, more yourself in that created sense.
Then there's applying amor fati, loving your fate. How can we use that practically?
Maybe use the eternal recurrence thought experiment, specifically when facing setbacks or failures. Instead of getting stuck in regret, if only, try asking, okay, how is this difficulty necessary? What strength did I gain or what detour did it force that contributes essentially to who I am now? Can I accept this, maybe even welcome it as part of the whole tapestry?
That reframes failure dramatically from something to regret into something potentially necessary.
It aims to transform resentment into acceptance or even affirmation. And finally, maybe cultivating authentic individualism, which doesn't mean just being contrary for the sake of it.
Right. It's more about
genuinely questioning popular opinion, herd mentality, the easy answers, developing intellectual independence, really trying to be the author of your own life story, not just a character playing a role someone else wrote for you.
So, stepping back from it all, what's the big final takeaway from Zarathustra?
For me, it's the sheer level of existential commitment the book demands. It fundamentally rejects the idea that the purpose of life is just passive happiness or comfort or obedience.
Instead, it proposes
that the purpose is the struggle itself, the constant, difficult, but potentially joyful process of self-overcoming. The enduring insight is that real meaning, genuine strength, even beauty. These aren't found in avoiding hardship, but are forged within it.
What surprised me, or what I really took away this time, was how Nietzsche turns this potentially bleak scenario, the death of God, the loss of old meanings, into something fundamentally, well, optimistic isn't quite the right word, maybe heroic.
Back, yes. Affirming.
Yeah.
It's this incredibly powerful call to create value, to embrace life fully, even with all its suffering, to not just tolerate existence, but to affirm it so profoundly that you'd welcome its infinite return. That's quite something.
It really is, and that's the ultimate measure, isn't it? Can you look at your life, all of it, the good and the terrible, and say with conviction, yes, thus I willed it once more? That, for Nietzsche, is the sign of having truly lived, of having touched the spirit of the Overman.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acantra Foundation.